Hello, everyone. Thanks for getting cozy with us tonight up in here. We're competing with so much tonight, so thanks for coming out. This is special. They're going to be in rehearsal at, what, 6 o'clock right now?
Yeah, it's only the children this evening. The children are doing a spacing and dress rehearsal, just their parts, because we like to introduce them to everything slowly. I think if we had them with all of the adults at once, it might be a little much.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. There's so much going on. And so thank you for coming out tonight. This is really going to be fun. Before we get started, there are a few people I would like to thank for making Views and Brews possible. And one is Casey Cheek. He's running sound right back there. Thank you, Mr. Casey Cheek. Also, behind the bar, we have Travis, Mike, and Chris. Thank you so much for all you do. And Daniel Berkowitz is taking your money. And so it's a very important job, actually, because Views and Brews wouldn't run without your contribution. So if you're feeling generous, five of you, please do give Daniel a few dollars. It's wonderful. Also, Matt Munoz and Amy Chambliss, who's sick this evening from the Cactus Cafe, do so much to make Views and Brews possible and bring us great shows. So thank you guys for all you do. And let's see, anything else I need to say before we get started? Facebook, Views and Brews is on Facebook. So please like us if you're in that realm. And I think that's it. Casey, what do you think? How are we doing? Good? Okay. So we are taping, and if you have a question, we will open it up for questions in a little bit. Just raise your hand, and Matt will come to you. You have to be on mic, though, or else we won't get it on tape. So let's begin with a little quote. My name is Rebecca McEnroe with KUT. And thanks for that, guys. To start out our discussion about tradition, reimagining tradition, Winston Churchill once said, "Without tradition, art is a flock of sheep without a shepherd. Without innovation, it is a corpse." Here with me to discuss what tradition is, the roles tradition play in our lives and how we understand our communities and ourselves, and what goes into reimagining tradition, longtime board member of Ballet Austin and the man who introduces Mother Ginger at Ballet Austin has done for the past 11 years, Richard Fothery, welcome. Hello.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to set my water down as well so I have a little bit more room. Also from Ballet Austin, the wardrobe assistant and shoe manager. We will find out what goes into managing the shoes for everyone. Emily Cawood, thank you so much for joining
us tonight.
And from right here at the University of Texas, the Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs for the College of Liberal Arts and Professor of Anthropology and Mexican American Studies, also author of Remembering the Alamo, Memory, Modernity, and the Master Symbol. Welcome, Dr. Richard Flores. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I would like to start out with you. Let's talk a little bit about tradition. What is tradition, and what is the difference between, say, you know, traditions and customs?
Well, traditions is a loaded word, and I think if we take a moment to think about it, all of us can think about personal traditions that we have, personal practices, habits that we fall into, sometimes consciously, sometimes rather unconsciously. But really what traditions are a set of practices or behaviors, or in this case, events, that have been selected out by us from the past. And they get selected out for a number of reasons, partly because they do something for us, they provide us comfort, they may provide particular meanings to us. But there is a lot of slipperiness when we talk about traditions. Many people think something traditional is something that has not changed. And they think of a tradition as something that has been passed down like an object from the past to the present in a rather unchanging way. And it's quite the opposite. Traditions are constantly changing. They're constantly in flux. And yet, we don't always become aware of it. And so, by tradition, by definition, it is something that we've been doing over time that has gained a particular significance for us.
And what is it about tradition that inherently has within it this idea that it has always been around, and that it doesn't change. Is that an important part of the tradition, that myth of permanence?
I think it is. If we think about the past, I also, when I teach about anthropology, I say you can't do good anthropology without also being a good historian. Because if we look at the past, there's no way we can capture what has happened in the past. Even a good historian will capture just segments of it. And we're constantly making decisions about what is important about the past. And so with tradition, we're constantly selecting out particular elements, again, that resonate with part of our experience. And that's the real important piece here.
And also, what's interesting to me about tradition is the way that dance plays a part in a lot of traditions, costumes play a part in a lot of traditions, these gender roles play a part, and the Nutcracker is really has all of these, you know, things going for it. What is really interesting to you about the Nutcracker in particular as a traditional institution?
Well, I think like most performative traditions, you can look at it in two ways. One, and this is what I call the performed event. So that is the story. What's the story of the Nutcracker? What is the staging of it? What's the music? What's the costuming of it? And so all of that carries its own traditional aspects of it. But then there is the performance event, and that's the larger frame. And you used the word reframing earlier, or reimaging. So there's the larger frame that we put around it. It's done at Christmas time. And so it's this combination of the event itself that's internal, the story, the dancing, the music, and the way it connects to this larger performed event that's done at Christmas time. And the dynamic between those two create a particular signification that I think for the Nutcracker is rather unique.
So let's talk a little bit about the story. Richard, you're well familiar with the story of the Nutcracker. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Nutcracker?
Yes, and Dr. Flores just mentioned about the Christmas time, and the first production of the Nutcracker was on December the 6th, 1892, in Russia, St. Petersburg, Russia, to be exact. And, of course, the story was written by E.T.A. Hoffman. The music, everyone knows, is Tchaikovsky. And I was reading the other day that it's one of the most, the Nutcracker music is one of the most recognizable musical events that anyone hears on a day-to-day basis. They just can relate to that. And the original ballet choreographer who choreographed it was a gentleman by the name of Marius Petipaw, and he originally choreographed it, Tchaikovsky did the music, and Mr. Hoffman had the story. And then it began to go into other parts of Europe in about 1919, and then into England in 1934. What was really interesting on the first production in 1892, it got bad reviews, except for the music. But everybody was a little bit confused about the choreography and the ballet itself. But then the first complete performance in the United States was done on December the 24th, going back to Christmas time, in 1944 by the San Francisco Ballet. So the United States was really kind of introduced to it in 1944. And then what really got the ballet, the Nutcracker, started in this country was by George Balanchine in New York. And he performed it in 1954. And then in the early 60s, the Nutcracker began to spread across the entire United States. And so individual companies throughout the United States, both small and large, began to pick up. And it at that point was considered a tradition, that it was part of what George Balanchine had brought to the United States, and this tradition spread across the United States. And for Austin in particular, the first performance was in 1962 at the Old Palmer Auditorium, and it was the Austin Civic Ballet in those days. So we'll be celebrating our 51st annual production this year of the Nutcracker. So that's just a little overview of where it came and how it survived and where it is today.
And it became popular really in the 60s. And Dr. Flores, you said that you had a theory about why that was. Why?
Well, when I look at events like this, events that begin and become so popular and now become part of a what we call a tradition, I ask the question, why? What is going on at the historical moment at which they're when they're introduced that gives rise to such an event? So I don't think it's just that it was done at Christmas time and that it was a ballet. I liken it to, you know, things that are going on in the country at the time. And if you think of 54 or the early 60s, you know, World War II had ended just a short time before. The Korean War had just ended in the 50s. There is a new world order emerging. There's the Cold War. The United States is playing a central figure in all this. And what do events like this do, especially as they're introduced across the country at this particular moment? But they begin to respond to us as a way of building a nation, or rebuilding a nation, or building a common framework that is the United States vis-a-vis the USSR at the time, or other forces that are emerging. And so I think the signification of the Nutcracker at that historical moment probably has something to do with Balanchine and ballet and Christmas, but I would suggest it has much more to do with who we are as a country and what's happening, and in particular with the emerging turmoil that is the 60s with the Vietnam War. And so I think all that comes to play there.
And it's really interesting. I mean, the story itself is so fascinating. Just this girl who's kind of having, you know, she's restricted by her family. She has to come together for Christmas. I'm sure nobody else has to, you know, come together with their families for Christmas. But she has to be here. And yet she's at this, she's hitting puberty. She wants to experience life. And so she has this kind of escapist dream or experience, you know. So the representation of someone escaping, say, the containment of the Cold War and experiencing this different dream world, this is really a significant play or significant ballet at this time.
And that particular theme actually resonates well. I mean, we just had the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, with Kennedy's own particular vision of the U.S. and, you know, his ideas about space travel and us going to the moon. And so there is this sense, as a country, we are expanding our horizons. In fact, the new frontier is how we talk about that.
Yeah, interesting. And so let's turn a little bit to the costumes. You know, the costumes are a way that we can get inside a different character and experience a new self. And Emily, you've worked for a while with Ballet Austin, so you've seen these costumes go through quite some turmoil. What was the conversation like when you first knew that you were going to change the costumes?
I was extremely excited. but then I'm always excited about new projects that we get to do and new designers that we get to work with. And having worked with those costumes personally since 2002, but knowing that they're older than that, it's fun to refresh things and to see something new. Even though the old costumes still are in pretty good condition, it was time for something new. It was time. I think as artists, sometimes you need to revisit something and refresh something, especially something that you do every year multiple times when you run it for an entire month. I was excited. I was very excited.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about some of the hinges that you've had in the past with these costumes.
With the past costumes?
Just for fun.
Some of the wardrobe malfunctions that we were starting to have.
We were talking earlier that you ought to see her and the other people from Wardrobe backstage. They're always with their needle and thread and a flashlight in their teeth, and they're doing this
yes.
all the time while the audience doesn't realize that.
Yeah, and we carry our flashlights in our teeth. We call them a bite light. We carry those backstage so that you can work with both of your hands and see what you're doing at the same time, since it's so dark backstage. But Yeah, since the old package is about 17 years old, when you have that much wear and sweat happening in a garment, things will start to eventually fall apart. Seams will start to give. Fabric will start to, especially more delicate fabrics, like lace, will start to rot in certain areas, especially around the armpits. I do remember one particular, the Russians. The Russians, as most of you know, have a very physical, their number is very physical. There's a lot of split jumping. And so one of the Russian dancers was warming up before act two, and he completely split the crotch of his pants open, and I had about 2 minutes to very, very quickly stitch him back into place. Yeah, right there backstage, right before he went on.
Something else about, I just think that's hilarious. So thank you for that.
That's my job.
One thing that I think is really interesting was a story that you told about, which I didn't get to hear, so I'd like to hear you say it, about the children inhabiting these new costumes and making up these stories about each costume as they're putting
it
on. Oh,
yes. So the children's fittings in particular have been very interesting because they've either had older siblings or they themselves have been involved in the Nutcracker for years. And so for them to show up and see new stuff that is different, especially for the younger children, was a little bit confusing. They didn't understand. They knew that it was going to be new costumes, but I didn't think they realized how new, that they didn't realize it was going to be something completely different looking than what they were familiar with. And so in particular, the mice, there are six little mice that come out at the very beginning of Clara's dream sequence near the end of act one. And our mice with our old package had very particular characters assigned to them. There were two little maids, there was a butler, there was a little gardener mouse and a cook mouse, and so they had very specific names and qualities, and their costumes reflected that. And so when the little mice came in for their fitting this year, they were all very confused. Well, which one's the cook and which one's the maid? This doesn't look, I don't understand who's who. And it took me explaining about two or three times that this is not the same. It's still the same choreography and you're still mice, but they're different looking than they used to be. And we don't have a maid anymore and we don't have a cook anymore, but we have these new characters. And so they stood around for a little while with kind of little confused looks on their faces, and then they started to rename their new characters. They started to give themselves characters, as such as one little girl says, well, I'm wearing a tailcoat, I'm the mayor, I'm the mayor mouse. And then this other little girl says, oh yes, well, I'm the mayor's wife. And so they all started to assign characters to themselves and create little backstories for their little characters. And then when the second cast came in, they immediately said, oh, you're the this mouse. And they began to relay what characters their counterparts were going to be playing now. So yeah, it was very, very cute.
Perhaps that starts a tradition.
It will.
Backstage,
it
yes.
Will. Yes.
But I think that's a key example of what we do with tradition. We take events and we reconfigure them to our own experience, to affirm some part of who we are, either as an individual or as a community, even though it doesn't necessarily fit the sort of the actual events of the past, but we take it and rewrite it and reshape it to our own needs. So I think that's a great story.
And another thing that's very interesting about the Nutcracker, especially at the Long Center from Ballet Austin, is the Mother Ginger character. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about introducing these Mother Gingers and who you've had, you know, to be Mother Ginger and kind of those experiences inhabiting those costumes and what personalities you see and stories you see come out of that.
Well, yes, the introduction opportunity of the Mother Gingers is fascinating, and I've been doing it for about the last 11 years, and I've seen a lot of different individuals come forth, and I always tell the audience, look at them now when I bring them out, because they're not going to look anything like this in a few minutes, and they're not. They're beautifully done in makeup, and we have a new Mother Ginger costume that I have not seen yet. And
yeah, we do.
Can you share with us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, our old Mother Ginger costume, and the current one is as well. The old one was very just one size fits most, because it has to fit a variety of body types. We've had someone as short as 4'11" and someone as tall as Ray Benson up in there, and so that's actually one of the challenges that we had with building the new Mother Ginger is how can we make this more workable for more body types, and especially knowing the kind of body types that we've had throughout the past 17 years that have worn it. So we've gone through and we've created panels that have zippers that we can unzip for people that might be wider, and we can zip them up for people that might be smaller. Inside the giant skirt, the Mother Ginger has to stand on a platform inside of a very, very tall hoop skirt that 16 children come out of. And so we've built a series of platforms that go inside so we can raise and lower. So if we do have another 4'11" Mother Ginger, it's not just her head peeking out of the top. We can see her full body. We did take care to make those tweaks and changes, which is also a good thing about revamping costumes. Now we kind of know what the production really needs, and we can fine-tune our new costumes to really fit that.
And I would like to just mention some of our past Mother Gingers that we started with. And the ballet created this opportunity to recognize individuals in the community that have been supporters of the ballet and enjoy having fun with themselves as Mother Ginger. And Dr. Flores, I've been looking at you, and I think maybe you would make a great Mother Ginger. I'm just looking at you.
I don't think that costume will fit me.
Yes, it will. It will.
It will. We'll make it work.
Back in 1997, Jody Conrad, of course, is the University of Texas women's basketball coach, may have been our first guest Mother Ginger that we had. And that year we also had then Mayor Kirk Watson, and Kirk came back and did it again as Senator Kirk Watson. Michael Dell, 1 year. Joe Sears, the Greater Tuna star. Ray Benson, she mentioned Ray. Ray's the tallest one we've ever tried to hoist up into there, and Ray did a great job. Ann Richards, she wasn't the governor at the time, but she came and did a great job. And their personalities come out before and during and afterwards. Augie Garrido, the baseball coach here at the university, he's great. We've had him a couple of times. Tom Kite, the golf legend. Lucy Baines Johnson, she was a lot of fun, and she really enjoyed it. And then U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison at the time, when she was U.S. Senator, she barely got there, and we thought we were going to have to do an understudy. Karen Hughes, who was the presidential advisor for President Bush. And then one of the most popular ones that we ever had was a young starting entertainer. He's done quite well now, Pat Green. And the audience just went wild over Pat. And let me give you a couple more.
You know, I'm curious, too. What is the asking process for you to ask somebody to be Mother Ginger's understudy?
Well,
you know, you're not quite important enough, but...
No, I'm just kidding.
I'll tell you who acts as the understudy. It's me. In the event that, for some reason... the Mother Ginger cannot perform. I have played it in the past, I've done it in the school shows. So I know what needs to be done. So I wait there to make sure Mother Ginger is alive and well before I leave.
I was just kidding. You're
that's...
you don't have to go through those awkward conversations.
If we can get Dr. Flores, he's not going to be an understudy. He's going to be a real Mother Ginger. Dr. Larry Faulkner, when he was president of the university. Kinky Friedman was a very interesting... And I got to tell you that Kinky backstage, I never will forget. He had that cigar. Of course, it wasn't lit. But he kept pacing back and forth and back and forth. And I thought, Mr. Friedman, are you? He said, well, no, I just don't know exactly what I'm going to do. And I said, well, you'll figure it out. And he did quite well. Joe Long of the Long Center, he has done it. He's a rather tall individual. And then we have, we started a tradition of getting people from Fort Hood. And we had a brigadier general back in 2004, and it was great to have a brigadier general as Mother Ginger. And then I think, in closing, one of the most interesting ones we had was Barbara Carson. Barbara was one of the founders of the Austin Civic Ballet. We actually call her the founder of the Austin Civic Ballet, and we got her to play Mother Ginger, and she was just delightful. And it's amazing to watch these people backstage, and then when they're getting their makeup on, and then when they transform themselves and they push them way up into this big platform, and then all of a sudden, and they're only on stage for 3 minutes, but it seems like 3 or 4 days for them.
Yeah.
It just goes on and on and on. But we have never had a Mother Ginger flunk the part. They do great, every one of them. So we're excited always to have our guest Mother Gingers.
And it's quite a symbolic role. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, traditions like this, having somebody who is elevated, who is from the community, being part of the tradition. What does that mean, anthropologically speaking?
I think that's a good question. I think, I'll put it in the context of the larger event as well. I was asking before we started here if the Nutcracker, how popular is it compared to other ballets? And what I was told is that it is actually the most popular ballet performed in the United States. And I think there's a reason for that. I may be totally wrong, this is a hunch. And that's because for most people, ballet is something they probably feel ill-equipped to understand. They probably don't have what we might call the cultural competence to interpret or appreciate what's going on in ballet. But the Nutcracker is different. Okay, the Nutcracker usually is a community event, and therefore bringing people like these folks to participate as Mother Ginger, I think, is a way to popularize this and actually recognize in this larger community who's here and why they're here and what's important to us. I think that's some of the role that these characters play.
And I'd just like to add that in the 50 years, this is our 51st year, in the 50 years prior, we've had approximately 2 million people see this production of Ballet Austin's The Nutcracker. And each year, we have about 13,000 students from the Austin and surrounding area school districts that are bused in, and they get to see a portion of The Nutcracker. So it's exposed. And then last year, it was year before last, I think, I was out in the audience prior to the show, and I saw these four beautiful ladies, and I just started visiting with them. And it was, speaking of traditions, it was a grandmother.
Visiting with beautiful ladies?
Yes, beautiful ladies. A grandmother, her daughter, a granddaughter, and a great-granddaughter had been all together there, and these girls had grown up through the years watching The Nutcracker, and I could just see the twinkle in their eyes. They were just happy to be there, and they came every year. It was exciting.
I think there's another way we can actually look at Mother Ginger, too. People don't always realize, but for centuries, Christmas celebrations were not all that sacred. There were many kind of bawdy, carnivalesque kind of celebrations around Christmas, especially during the medieval period. And those traditions began to get tamed in the late 1700s, 1800s. And I think actually the Nutcracker is one of the ways in which it does get more tamed. But you find elements in some of these events, like Mother Ginger, which you might call a role reversal, where you take people of high importance in a community and you put them on stage in a rather farcical, carnivalesque kind of manner. And it creates this kind of reversal of character. And that's always a sign of humor and good time.
And I'm thinking of, we had our police chief when he first came to town, Art Acevedo, and he just, I mean, all of a sudden came alive.
He's so shy. Really.
Yeah, you know.
It's interesting. You know, something really fascinating, too, about dance, as I was looking into this idea of ballet, was the way that the Russian, the Bolshevoi ballet, was used as a diplomatic tool. So people would come, and there was no language barrier, and so they could watch ballet, and it kind of was very inclusive. What is it about the Nutcracker that gives us a sense of understanding culture without really saying anything, without having to understand the language? There's something in each dance which is really representative of these different kind of cultures and how we understand culture. Any ideas there? Culture without words? Or even, you know, through the costumes, too.
I first think of the music, because, again, it's such a well-known piece of music. But the Sugar Plum Fairy, I mean, everybody kind of knows the Sugar Plum Fairy. It just becomes kind of a traditional thing to go see the Sugar Plum Fairy and Clara and her dream and so forth.
I think part of it is we experience reality with multiple senses and on multiple registers. And I think dance is one of those that's not verbal. You know, I don't think we give it much attention, but, you know, if you're a dancer, you give it a lot of importance and you weigh your steps very carefully. But, and so it begins to signify for us in ways that we're probably not really conscious. And you're right, it is a non-verbal way of communicating. And I do think there's something about those kinds of registers that, you know, I think we lose over time if we don't use them. I mean, while we're a very visual culture, we're also visual in terms of words. I mean, you think of the digital age and, you know, email and texting. And yet, just to see symbols that are nonverbal, I think they do resonate with us, but it's not something we pay a lot of attention to. And they carry a lot of meaning.
Yeah. And, you know, I just had a thought as he was saying that the dance of the Snow Queen and her cavalier and the pas-de-deux that they do, it is when the snow is drifting from the ceiling. I've seen that dance I don't know how many times, but every time I see it, I have that feeling of warmth and comfort and joy and excitement. And this year will be no different, even in new costumes. How about the Snow Queen? What is she going to look
like? How about this? So traditionally, we've had the snow couple, the Snow King and Queen, have been in white and silver, which is what traditionally most of the snow couples tend to wear. But in our new production, they're this very fantastic royal blue velvet with accents of silver and light blue and white, kind of very icy looking. And the fantastic thing about that is they will be set against this very pale backdrop, so they'll really pop out, and they'll very, very much stand out amongst the Snow Corps, which is all the girls in the Snow Corps. There's 12 of them. They're all in silvery and an antique white color. So it'll be really, really beautiful. They'll really stand out.
And I just had a thought. Well, we've got this new set design. Did we get a new load of snow for the scene?
Or are we going to use the same old snow?
Same old snow.
Same old snow. No, that snow is really beautiful. I think they probably redo new snow every year, because towards the end of December, it does get a little interesting. They
recycle the snow.
They recycle the snow every year. They do recycle the snow. It's bits of mylar, silver mylar, and white plastic. It's all these chopped up small, teeny tiny squares, which when the girls come off stage and they take their tutus off, they're usually dumping snow on their costumes. But it's all these bits of plastic and mylar that are hung in this cradle above the stage, and it's very gently rocked by the flymen so that it sifts through these holes and falls. And so when they sweep it up at intermission, they do sift through it to get out anything that might have been on the stage that shouldn't be, so that it doesn't snow hairpins and sequins and what have you on the next go round.
Well, we'll definitely talk about what these traditions mean to you, you know, backstage and in this situation that you're in. But I'd like to open it up for questions, first of all. Are there any questions? I'm sure. Yeah, Diane. It's under in the back and up front. Where's Matt? Did he just take off? Okay. You can't wear black anymore to these, Matt, because I can't see you.
There's one right there.
Okay, one second, and we got to come to you because we got to get it on tape. Oh, she's not getting it to work. Little microphone problem there. Okay, there we go.
Okay, for those of us who can't even tolerate it when the newspaper guy can't get the, you know, newspaper in the same place on the driveway every morning, am I even going to recognize the mice as mice? Or are they going to look like, you know, rats?
Oh, no, they are definitely mice. There was a gentleman in London who did all of our mask and headpiece work. He builds things for Disney. He builds these incredible things, and they definitely do look like mice. They are, when I opened the box that they arrived in, I literally squealed like an 8-year-old girl. I was just way too excited. They've got these chubby cheeks and these whiskers and these giant ears, and they're soft and they're furry, and they'll have little fat suits and velveteen tails, and they're absolutely
my traditions.
See, this is the thing too that your question speaks to, Diane, which is what happens when we kind of, you know, shake that. What is that nervousness about experiencing something that we might not be familiar with, like we have been in the past? You know, what does that really speak to in our psyche and as a people?
Well, I think over time we become accustomed to certain kinds of images, and I think what we need to do, we use the word recognize, we need to recognize them again, which means to recognize them. We need to see them differently and see them with, you know, a new set of lenses almost. I mean, one thing we know for sure is that our brains are very flexible, and they do and can assimilate all kinds of new information. But holding on to those former ways of understandings is really more about us not wanting to change. In fact, many times when I talk about tradition, I contrast it with authenticity. And if there, you know, authenticity is really something that we've determined to be real. There's nothing organically authentic about much. In even the natural world, we give it a particular significance. So, I mean, as an anthropologist, if you study how people understand the natural world, people understand it very differently across the globe. So those things that we then construct humanly is something that we've created and we've deemed authentic. But it's really because we've determined it to be or said it to be, but it can be otherwise. But to make it otherwise takes us sometimes out of our comfort zone. But we know that as humans, we can definitely move out beyond our comfort zone.
And the idea of originality is kind of makes us a little bit nervous, so it has to be originality perhaps within a framework also is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We talk a lot about innovation. And I talk about this to my students too, because as you know, as students, especially PhD students, they're supposed to write an original dissertation. What does that mean? If you talked, and I've heard interviews with some really interesting musicians, and one I heard in particular was Ray Charles. And it was like, well, how can he improvise so well? And he said, well, I spend 2 to 3 hours a day playing scales. And so it's his understanding of the fundamentals that allows him to move beyond it. And I think that's really something about originality. It's understanding the foundations or the basic rudiments of something that allow you then to play with it in a way that makes sense.
And you know, I just had a thought as you said that for our dancers in the professional company, every day when they come to work to rehearse, they start with ballet class and they go through the fundamentals. And before a Nutcracker performance or any performance, they come early and they have class. And the artistic director and the artistic staff work with them individually and as a group. So the fundamentals because the basics of ballet, they take it and go from there.
And you must see this also, Emily, like that the costumes can't diverge too much. You know, they're really, they have to be recognizable as well.
Right. I guess maybe it's kind of like, maybe like repainting your house. Like the structure is still the same, but we've just refreshed it and made it a little bit newer. The costumes that we have that Judanna Lynn has designed, she has set them in the era of about the 1830s, which would be about the time that E.T.A. Hoffman's story would have been set. So they will be very recognizable. We didn't go too far. I know there are versions of Nutcracker out there that go, I mean, there are some that go way far out there. They have some set in orphanages. They have some Nutcrackers that are all dogs. They have Nutcrackers that are, I mean, it can go any number of ways, but we've still maintained the same structure that we've had. Our storyline at Ballet Austin has stayed the same. We've added a character or two here and there, but the structure of the ballet is the same. The choreography is the same. We just put a new coat of paint on it.
Yeah. Can I just say right now that the city of Austin is fortunate, extremely fortunate, that we have someone like Stephen Mills as our artistic director, and his staff, and all those who work with these dancers on a daily basis, and Cookie Ruiz, who's our executive director, and her professional staff, and everything they do to bring these shows together. We are fortunate in Austin to have such professional and wonderful people to lead our ballet.
Mm-hmm. Another question?
Yes, thank you. I have a couple questions. First of all, you said the costumes and the set were new. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, they are designed.
Yes, the costumes and sets are new.
And the choreography is the same.
The choreography is the same. There are a few tweaks and changes here or there to maybe accommodate some of the new costuming, but it's not anything that someone's going to come in and say, oh my goodness, this isn't it, this isn't mm-hmm. it. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Also, the, the costumes that are new now, are the former costumes, are they going to be rented out or to other companies that may need them in the future?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we carefully went through at the beginning of this season. Alexi and I, he's also works in wardrobe with me. He and I went through and cataloged everything of the previous production, everything that we felt like we could rent out or potentially sell to a smaller company. So we've gone through and we've cataloged all of that. We've packed it up and it's packaged. So yes, it's ready to be sold to a smaller company or rented out. And it's pretty much the full production. It's my understanding that both, yes. Yes.
Okay. Is the microphone not working? Mm-hmm. Oh, one more question? And also, they've been really under wraps about the costumes, and we were going to hopefully, you know, show some sketches this evening or show some of the costumes, but we couldn't do that. But Timothy Dillon from Ballet Austin has some brochures which have the sketches of the new costumes in them, so you can pick one of those up on your way out. Go ahead.
Yes, I was actually quite amazed to find out that this is such a recent, quote, tradition. When I think of tradition, I think of hundreds of years, or 100 years. And I was actually shocked to find out that this was since the 60s or when, well, but as a tradition when it really got started. If we went outside the United States and went to Europe and London, Paris, Moscow, wherever, is there a similar tradition around the Nutcracker there or is this a has this become an American phenomenon?
Emily, I think you can answer that. Our wardrobe master grew up in Russia, in the Ukraine, and his mother and father, one was the artistic director, I think, and the other one was the...
Yes, his father was an artistic director for a theater, and his mother was a costume designer and a costume maker. Actually, she still does some projects for us here and there.
And what did he tell you about the
Nutcracker?
And
what he told me
about
Nutcracker is that no one really does it there anymore. And if they do, he told me that the few times that he did perform it when he was dancing with the ballet in Ukraine, he said that if they do it, it's not necessarily at Christmas time. I mean, it's just possibly in your rep for that year, and you might do it in July. It's just another ballet of the many that they do. Yeah.
It's interesting. Is there something that you feel has been kind of lost from the ballet world? Are people really reinventing ballet now, do you feel? Or is it not the same as it used to be, for example?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot more influences, I think, of like modern and contemporary dance going into it and exploring different movement but using the same ballet language. At Ballet Austin, we do a mix. We do a few classical ballets in a year, but then we'll also do several contemporary works that Stephen Mills will create, or we'll invite other choreographers to come in. And the movement has a very ballet base, but with a modern twist, with more modern movement and shapes, and creating his own language for movement that he has created himself. So yeah.
There's also something I think really interesting about the way that the Nutcracker in particular is appropriated by different dance companies and different people around the country. And one thing is, we just had this Dance Your Own Nutcracker recently, last weekend, I think it was. What is it about this story that's knowing, it's so traditional that it's easy to subvert and to create different meaning, you know, surrounding the Nutcracker. What is that tradition about?
Well, I think what I mentioned earlier about how Christmas, many Christmas celebrations at one point were actually about subverting a lot of the time of the year. I actually had done, in an earlier project, I did work on a Mexican shepherd's play that's celebrated at Christmas time. It's called Los Pastores. And this is a descendant of these medieval morality plays performed at Christmas, and what they would do, a lot of them were very different, but they would do stuff like take the local, they would take a donkey, a jackass, and dress him up as the Pope, okay, as a way of subverting, you know, power, as a way of doing those kinds of things. So I think subversion has always been part of various forms of rituals, especially rituals at high moments. And so I don't think it's uncommon to find these kinds of things going on with the Nutcracker.
Are there any more questions? No? We're coming to, just about the end.
Can I mention this?
Oh, of course, yeah. I'll ask that at the very end. But before we close, I would just like to ask each of you, you know, what do you think is really important about keeping these traditions alive, you know, traditions like the Nutcracker, like ballet, like these things that we can pass down. From each of your unique perspectives, what is important about this, and why do you think that's significant? Richard, I'll start with you.
To me, it just brings back my youth. Oh, that Richard. Excuse me. We got two Richards up here.
Go ahead.
No, that's Dr. Floyd.
Please.
It just brings back to me the feeling that I had when I was a child at Christmas time. As I mentioned about the snow scene, I grew up in the Panhandle of Texas, and I used to see snow, and it just reminds me of my youth, and it's full of warmth and joy. So that's the tradition that I get from, and plus the dancing and the music is just beautiful.
Yeah. Emily?
I grew up as a student of dance. I grew up going to the Nutcracker. It was a special occasion for that year, but it was something that my whole family would go to see dance-wise. So, I mean, like Richard said, I mean, it brings back a lot of feelings in my youth and my family, and it's a very special time. It was a special thing that we got to do together when I was growing up. But also, I think that the Nutcracker is also a thing, because it's such a tradition with certain people, they bring other people to share in that tradition with them. And so then the tradition continues to grow. And for a lot of people, it's the first ballet that they do come to see, because someone for whom it is a tradition has invited them to share in that with them.
And Richard?
Well, I think, echoing some of what they've said, I think it's about the ways in which families participate, because these kinds of events, you know, create community within families, but they also create community across families. This whole story of Mother Ginger, and who plays Mother Ginger, and the way that has become elevated in the city of Austin, or even in this area. It's a way for us to sort of poke fun at people, and laugh together, and come together, and we don't often do that. I mean, I was sitting here thinking, what other event in Austin does that, you know, maybe beyond some local political event? But here's an event that people recognize as very familial, and is a time to be together and share together, almost regardless of what's happening on stage. I think what's happening on stage adds to it, but it's the season and it's the moment, and that's how communities get made.
Yeah. And so tell us how we might go see this if we don't have tickets already.
Well, we're going to build this year as our world premiere with our new sets and our costumes. The performances are December the 7th through the 23rd. That's not every night, but it runs during that time. All the performances are at the Long Center. Tickets start at $15 all the way up to $75, just like any other venue. You're going to sit where you pay, but they're all good seats in the Long Center. And another nice thing about the Long Center is the acoustics are just incredible, so you can hear the beautiful music that goes with it. So to get tickets, visit the Ballet Austin website at balletaustin.org, or write this number down, 512-476-2163. That's our box office. Again, 512-476-2163. The evening performances begin the curtain at 7:30. The matinee performances at 2 p.m. And we invite everyone to come enjoy the tradition.
Beautiful. Well, it's been wonderful having you all. I would like to invite everybody for our next Views and Brews, which is next Tuesday at 6 again, where we'll be discussing the life of Leonard Bernstein. And thank you, Dr. Richard Flores and Emily Caldwell and Richard Fothery, for coming out this evening. Really appreciate it. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Timothy Dillon, as well, for putting everything together. And thank you for coming, our meager little crowd. Have a wonderful night.